Welcome to the Sensible Socialist Podcast, a podcast for the rational left.
We need to unite and work together if we're all going to get through this.
Sounds like socialism to me.
The amount of people I see talking about socialism positively is actually staggering.
Do you think, do you really think that a proletarian revolution is just around the corner in America?
Grab your pitchforks and stab your mayor.
No hero Obama.
He's not my hero. How heroic he does.
If Bernie Sanders were president, right, and he wanted to bring the same ideas for socialism into this country, do you think that we would benefit? But I just told you Venezuela's eating rats.
But I just want people to have health care. I don't want,
Same thing Hugo Chavez.
Oh my god.
You people have, worms in your brain, honestly.
All right, welcome to this episode of the Sensible Socialist Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Gustafson. And today we're going to talk about, obviously, what's been going on in the last few weeks since we released the last episode, which is, of course, the 2020 insurrection, or the George Floyd protests. So, for now the last week or two, protests have raged all around the world after George Floyd was murdered on the streets of Minneapolis. In the wake of the killing, and the protection of the police who committed the murder, people from all over the country and even the world, local area, descended on Minneapolis, protested. There was rioting, destruction of property, taking over police stations. Groups in cities all over the world have marched and protested, and police continued to use tear gas, rubber bullets, and other quote-unquote less than lethal means to quote-unquote maintain order. So I've heard a lot of commentary. There's been a lot of ways of sort of looking at this and trying to understand this, but I wanted to kind of present what I think is the socialist perspective. What do socialist thinkers sort of going on, and how is we as socialists, should we understand what's going on? How is this, and is this actually connected to the larger struggle against capitalism? And if it isn't, how can we make it so? So to do this, we need to, as often is the case, go back into history and talk about where we got here and where we are today. So we have to arbitrarily start somewhere. So we're going to start at the European colonization of the quote-unquote New World. The basic premise of the development of what would become the United States of America was a dual project of settler colonialism and white supremacy. So if we start and look at the beginning of the colonial period in the United States, it is a period of white expansionism into already settled indigenous lands that resulted in indigenous genocide. There were millions and millions of Native Americans here, tens of millions. And by the time you had the sort of quote-unquote conquest of America and the fulfillment of manifest destiny, you had maybe a million, probably less than that. So you're talking about a massive genocidal kind of period, openly genocidal in terms of the United States position towards Native Americans. And I think it's really important to understand that part of the justification for stealing Native American land was that Native Americans did not have a proper property system like that they had in, say, England or France or in Europe. And so because the indigenous people did not have this kind of idea about, marking off a place and making a plot of land and saying, I own this land and I am able to alienate it to whoever I want to and I can do whatever I want with this land. They didn't have that kind of idea. And so the idea of white legal theorists is that basically they didn't have that idea. We can carve out the land and take it for us because we do. And that was the way in which you had white encroachment into Native American lands. And when Native Americans fought back, the white settlers killed them and destroyed their villages, destroyed their cities, basically just wiped them out through a, you know, 250-year campaign of forced removal or murder, and what you would see in the Rome statutes of the International Criminal Court as obviously genocidal acts. If the United States committed the acts it did against Native Americans today, it would be, at least in principle, subject to subject to international prosecution at the International Criminal Court. So that's just the first bit of context that I think is really important to understand about the foundations of the United States as a nation state. But of course, in terms of the most relevant to what's going on today and the whole history of white supremacy and the oppression and exploitation of black people is, of course, slave importation. And it's not a mystery to anyone. I'm not going to be teaching anyone a lesson that the entire economy of the antebellum, so the pre-Civil War South, was based on the destruction of and exploitation of black labor, and not through the means that you exploit labor under capitalism, which is to rent people, but through the ownership of individuals in a sort of chattel system, not different than farm implements. This kind of degradation of black people in general was understood in the context of white supremacy. That, look, white people are better than black people, and black people are inherently inferior, and so there was a whole ideology that suggested that basically white people had the white man's burden of making black people full human beings. And this was a widespread idea. I mean, I think for me, one of the most sort of apparent of this is you look at Abraham Lincoln, the sort of, you know, liberator of slaves in terms of the American mythology. He was a white supremacist. He didn't believe in the equality of black people and white people. And he made it very clear in the Lincoln-Douglas debates and other places that the emancipation of slaves was not the equality of black people. And so even in terms of the abolition of slavery, when that happened, did not come with it this idea that black people were, you know, equal to white people. And that ideology has been pervasive throughout the history of the United States. So white supremacy in the run-up to the Civil War, the whole Civil War was fought over the issue of whether or not you could enslave the black race. Then the entire Reconstruction period, the development of the Ku Klux Klan, black codes, which, you know, essentially set up an apartheid system where black people were under certain laws and white people under different laws. The development of Jim Crow, in which this was put into, you know, statutory and code books, and the transformation of that after, you know, the civil rights movement into police brutality and the use of criminal justice as the new Jim Crow, that, of course, the famous Michelle Alexander book does an amazing job displaying. That this is all to say that there is a long and deep history of white supremacy that runs from the beginning of the American Project until now. And so if the perspective that you don't have doesn't at least include white supremacy, then it's a faulty premise. At the same time, if your perspective only is about white supremacy, you're also missing the entire context, which is the development of capitalism in the United States and the way in which capitalism, when it became dominant in the entire United States after the Civil War, used the position of white supremacy to divide the now black and white working class, proletariat working class, in terms of a capitalist mode of production. And so you have the ruling class in a capitalist system, the capitalists, seeing the major advantage in destroying the unity of the working class by maintaining, exacerbating, and fully entrenching the maintenance of white supremacy. So this is not just a white-black issue. This is an economic issue with racial characteristics. And I think that is a very important sort of flag post that we all should put so that we know that we're not talking about just a problem with white people or even a problem with black people or some kind of white-black only dynamic. We need to talk about white-black dynamics in the larger context of the inherently oppressive and exploitative system of capitalism. think it's important to note that it isn't as if black people have just let this sort of happen. And there's been example after example of black resistance to white supremacy in the Civil War and a number of different, I mean, there's been slave uprisings, most famously in Haiti, obviously, but then you have Nat Turner and other slave uprisings happening in the United States. You have the Underground Railroad, black soldiers in the Civil War. You've got the whole rise of black nationalism and black self-defense, getting to the period of like civil rights, Martin Luther King, and I think more importantly, Malcolm X and the Black Panthers. And now you have Black Lives Matter. And so you always have these examples of black people responding to and fighting for their rights. And so I think in some ways it is a big problem for the ideology of white supremacy that you have the constant resistance of black people against it. Because if black people were actually inferior, then that probably wouldn't happen. So they're showing their equality in the fact that they're resisting like any other human being would understandably do. And so white supremacy in the United States has been always needed to be enforced through some kind of use of force, through violence. And I think that it's been fairly obvious that the entity in the institution in society who is given the ability to do that, to use force or use the threat of force to enforce the rule of law, are the police. And you can go through a very long list of innocent, unarmed black people who have been killed by the police. And that's not only in the last year, which is way too long, or the last 5 years, the last 10 years, we're talking about hundreds of years of this kind of police brutality and violence against black people. This is nothing new. And there are times in which black people have said, we're not going to take this. And white allies have joined them and said, this is an unfair and unequal system. It isn't the case that every white person believes in or wants to see white supremacy in society. It is the case that the ideology of white supremacy has been useful for the maintenance of the current economic and political social system. And so there, I don't believe very much that the majority of, say, white people really believe in or want to ensure and manifest white supremacy in the society. But that doesn't mean that this white supremacist ideology is not part of the society or not built into the institutions. It is, but it is for a very specific purpose, not because there's something widespread about the adherence to the ideology of white supremacy, but because the institutional manifestations of it are very useful for the ruling class to maintain their position as the ruling class. And so I think that it's important to remember that the violence specifically against black people is partly to maintain the institutions of white supremacy. There's no doubt about that. But the maintenance of the institutions of white supremacy are there because they benefit the bourgeoisie, not all white people, because not all white people are benefited by a system of white supremacy within the context of a capitalist economic system, because white people are exploited. Now, compared to black people, because black people have been the underclass in American society, that the sort of white working class has relative advantages as compared to the black working class. There's no doubt about that either. But the working class in general, white, black, and otherwise, are exploited in the same way. Not to the same degree, and I think that's very important, but in the same way. Because the exploitation is not fundamentally about black and white. It's about capitalist and worker. And I think that's an important thing to remember. A lot of the discussions that have come out of the recent protest movement, specifically around George Floyd's murder, have talked about what we do with the police. Now, we've seen what the police do when they're confronted with protests, both peaceful and not, which is to use excessive force. Because the police in the United States are paramilitary forces, basically. And so they think of themselves as a counterinsurgency force in a society that is fundamentally against them. And that's why they look at people in the way that they look at people, which is usually as a threat, some kind of enemy. And they are empowered by the state with the monopoly use of force so that they can do it with relative impunity. So we need to talk about the role of the police in the society in the context of what is the role of the law in society, because the police are there to enforce the laws. But the question is, who do the laws help? And in a capitalist mode of production, in a bourgeois republic with a capitalist mode of production like we have in the United States, the laws are made by a legislature that is bought, owned, and controlled by the ruling class. So the laws that they make are going to be in the interests of the maintenance of the rule of the ruling class. Now, sometimes that ironically looks like a welfare program, because if they didn't have the welfare program, the ability for the ruling class to maintain its control would be harder. So these are bargains that the ruling class makes to say, yes, we'll give some bit of something to the workers, because if we don't, we know revolution is right around the door. The ruling class knows very, very, very clearly how close revolution is if they didn't do certain things. And so they twist the knobs just enough to keep people occupied, satisfied, busy, or distracted, so that they don't fundamentally recognize that they're being exploited. So the laws in a society are there to maintain the rule of the ruling class, and the police are there to enforce those laws. Much of that, and if we look at the history of the police, particularly in America, is about protecting property from either theft or destruction. And this goes back all the way, obviously, to fugitive slaves, that the creation of the modern police force that we know in the United States comes from capturing escaped, quote-unquote, property, runaway slaves. And so there were, you know, obviously slave codes, and it was illegal for a slave to run away, and it was illegal to harbor a slave and those kinds of things. And so you had to have some way of enforcing that. And when you're talking about a situation of somebody fleeing their life, you usually need force in order to be able to actually enforce those laws. And so you have a group of people who are given the ability to enforce the laws, given the monopoly use of power and force, and do so against slaves, which is, again, how you see the nexus between the rule of law and the police and their role in maintaining the rule of law and white supremacy. I think that's very important. But when we look at the foundations of America, this capitalist mode of production, a weak welfare state, the history of white supremacy, and a very anti-revolutionary perspective, you can see what the actual role of the police are. And the role of the police are to maintain the system at all costs. And the system is fundamentally oppressive and exploitative. And so you need force to maintain that system, because you're not getting consent by people, because people understand that it's fundamentally oppressive and exploitative. Deep down inside, they sort of know there's something wrong with the system. But they don't think that there's a way that they'd actually be able to fix anything, because look at all the barriers to doing it. Namely, the police. If you had a protest that says, you know what, we should take over City Hall and do that, you know very well that the people who are going to come after you are the police, and they have guns. And they use those guns. And so everybody kind of understands that at the end of the day, though the police do way more functions than they need to, and we can have a conversation about shifting the burden of dealing with certain aspects in society away from the police and onto other things in society, which I think is an important conversation, but you're fundamentally never going to get rid of the fact that the police are there to maintain an illegitimate system by force. And so long as you have that illegitimate system in place, you are going to have a police force, and it is going to use force and violence in order to maintain the system. So that leads me to talking about defunding or abolishing the police. There's been a lot of talk about this, and I think it's an important conversation. And as I've said, defunding the police makes perfect sense if you're going to maintain a capitalist system. Let's shift the burden away from people who tend to want to use fists and guns to people who want to use reason and logic. I think that makes perfect sense. And there are so many resources given to police that don't need to be given to police that can be given to other people that I think we should absolutely do that with no issues at all. But if we're talking about abolishing the police, getting rid of the law enforcement mechanism, I think that you have two fundamental problems. One, some of the laws in the capitalist system are justifiable laws, laws against personal injury, personal violence, those kinds of things. These are legitimate laws. These are laws or prohibitions that you'd want to have in a socialist system or any system, basically. And anytime there's been any kind of civilized system, you've had rules or codes against things like theft, things like violence against other people. So you need a way to enforce legitimate laws. And that function is going to be what we might call the quote-unquote police, or whoever is given the law enforcement power. So if the police are there to enforce the laws and maintain the system, and you're talking about abolishing the police, the system is going to need a means of enforcing itself. And it does so, if it's fundamentally illegitimate and exploitative, as capitalism is, through force. So even if you were successful at abolishing the police, which I don't think you'll actually be successful, partially because of who actually would be in charge of abolition, which I think would be legislatures, which are obviously bought and controlled by the ruling class, who have no interest in getting rid of the police. But even if you were to somehow abolish the police in some other way, assuming a capitalist mode of production, the police will come back. The laws will be enforced by someone, and that someone will have the monopoly use of force given to them by the state, because it's the state who is trying to enforce the laws. So you, in my opinion, cannot abolish the police while maintaining capitalism. That if you want to abolish police, which I think is a noble goal, and I ultimately want to abolish the police and not have a need for force to be used to get consent, basically. But if your system has contradictions that it cannot get out of, and those contradictions are exploitative or oppressive or fundamentally illegitimate, then you're going to have the use of force. So we need to, if we're talking about police abolition, look at the necessary preconditions to actually abolishing the police. And that is to create a system that doesn't have the perverse incentives that demand law enforcement. But if you maintain a distinction between people where some employ others and exploit their labor to make profits and create the inequality in society that inherently engenders, and it creates the instability that it engenders, you are going to have people who are going to engage in acts against the system. And the system is going to respond to those in any means necessary. And it is going to use anything it can, including widespread and systematic violence, to maintain itself. So if you want to abolish the police, you got to have a perspective that abolishes capitalism first, because capitalism will always need police to function. So if your position on police abolition is not an anti-capitalist position, and is not, frankly, a primarily anti-capitalist position, I don't think you have a leg to stand on. The last thing I want to talk about in this episode are the limits of the protest movement. We saw a week of intense protests involving riots, property destruction, police response and brutality. We really saw what happens when the system and its institutions are fundamentally challenged. They respond with force. But I think what happened with the protest movement was very interesting, that over the course of the week of June 1st through June 6th, what you saw was an eruption of frustrated, relatively disorganized people who went after certain targets and a Target store. What you also saw was people who are in some ways bent on destruction and who want to see things burn saw the opportunity to go make things burn. And there are people in society who want to do that. And sometimes that's not illegitimate. Sometimes it doesn't help. And I think in this case, it certainly woke people up and made people realize that there really was something fucked up that we needed to look at. But it also turned a lot of people against what otherwise would have had widespread support. And so I think as a tactic, looting can be very problematic. I get it. It's understandable, but it doesn't usually justify itself. And you usually make more enemies than you gain. So if you're promoting looting as a tactic, I think it's a bad tactic to promote. If people start looting, it's usually not planned. So the protests continued, though. And what happened was a lot of the people who were engaged in that kind of property destruction got arrested. And they were in jail. And so the protest movement moved very much away from radical property destruction, kind of focused, very much confrontational with the police, to peaceful protests. And this is something that most people sort of want to see, are the peaceful protests, the protests that don't fundamentally challenge the institutions in our society, but simply call out something that is obviously unjust. This culminated in this George Floyd protest movement on the protests on Saturday, June 6th. Now, I live in Washington, D.C., and so the protests, both violent and nonviolent, were in my own city, and I was able to see some of those. And I can tell you that the protests, the first few nights, were fundamentally a challenge for the police and were threatening to the police, and from their perspective, demanded that they use extreme measures, including tear gas and rubber bullets and all kinds of things, to maintain order. It couldn't have been more different on the protests on June 6th. There were way more people on June 6th, but it was the least threatening protest I've been to or seen since the Women's March, which was, again, a group of a huge amount of people, a revolutionary amount of people, but for whom there was no threat at all to the system or the status quo. That is what happened on June 6th in 2020. The protest movement that was angry, confrontational, and a fundamental challenge had been totally defanged, both by police action and by the wider liberal order. There is this widespread idea that peaceful protests good, not peaceful protests bad. And what you wanted, what you saw within the protest movement was a complete turn away from confrontational and threatening to orderly and peaceful. And what that means from the perspective of the ruling class is victory, because the protest movement is basically null and void at this point. We're talking about June, the second week of June, and it's gone. Where are you seeing these protests? You're maybe seeing blips and things like that, but nothing like you saw certainly on the 6th of June, and nothing like you saw at the first few days of the protest. And it's partly because there were no list of demands. Now, the Movement for Black Lives had a list of demands, but it wasn't some kind of widespread thing that every protest said, these are our demands and we're not going to stop protesting until our demands are met, which is how you're supposed to have a protest. A protest is kind of like taking hostage of the system. But if you take a hostage, you're supposed to make demands. And if your demands get met, you let go of the hostage. Well, in this situation, we took a hostage and didn't ask for anything. So what were we expecting? And the ruling class knew this, the legislatures knew this, the people in power knew this, the police knew this, so they knew all they had to do was wait. Wait until this fizzled out. And fizzled out it has. So much of the focus now is on what Minneapolis is doing, which is defunding the police, getting rid of the Minneapolis police as we knew it, and reforming it into something different, which is a noble goal, but it is not A, abolishing police, or B, fundamentally challenging why we need police. And so these are now a liberal movement that is going to be picked up by certain Democrats. And what happens when the Democrats get a hold of a social movement? It dies. And that's exactly what's going to happen here. At best, you're going to see this funneled into attempted support for Joe Biden. And is that really what these protests should ultimately be about? Should that be the consequence of George Floyd's death? that we should vote for someone who voted for more police and who's always been in favor of the police? I don't think so. But I fear that that is going to be the ultimate consequence that we see from this movement. That's what happens when you don't connect white supremacy, police violence, and capitalism. That's why we need the capitalist critique. Because without a capitalist critique of the current system, it gets defanged and moved into liberalism. That's what we're seeing with this movement. And it breaks my heart because I wanted to see this insurrection be a fundamental challenge to the system. And it's not. It's something that the system can handle and the system will absorb and will continue on exploiting, oppressing, and destroying the lives of all the people that it does. We are looking very soon at a widespread depression in the United States, which will have massive, massive consequences for white and for black people. And if this doesn't connect to the white supremacy and the police violence, then I don't know what will.
You're saving your money by lending it to Uncle Sam. See, Uncle Sam needs that money to build ships and planes, tanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Sensible Socialist Podcast. This podcast is supported by listeners like you, and no advertisements or anything will ever be said. If you want to support the podcast, please go to patreon.com/sensiblesocialist and give today. Also, please give us a review or a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to the podcast, as it greatly helps. All right, see you next time.